This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Everyone complains about traffic in Connecticut. Now, what are you doing to encourage your town or city officials to rethink street designs and increase safety measures? Coming up, we'll hear how New Haven has implemented low-cost approaches on its city streets. Also, do roundabouts or rotaries or traffic circles cause you anxiety on the road? They're one way to ease traffic and make roads safer. We'll check in with an expert across the pond. Kevin Beresford leads the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society. Our conversation just ahead. First, New York City has managed to decrease the number of traffic fatalities. For more on this, we're joined from the studios of SRF Radio in Zurich, Norman Garrick, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UConn. He's currently serving as a visiting professor at the Institute for Transportation Planning and Systems at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. Norman, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. It's nice to be on again.
Now, also with us on the phone is town planner and urban designer, founder of town planning firm Dover Cole & Partners. That's Victor Dover, also co-author of the book Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Victor, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning, Lucy. Thanks.
So, Norman, I wanted to start with you. The news out of New York City in last year, the city hit its lowest number of traffic fatalities since record keeping began back in 1910. Specifically, pedestrian deaths have plummeted to their lowest level, dropping by a third. And there's a lot of attention on this Vision Zero policy. Tell us about this idea and where it came from.
Well, the Vision Zero started in Sweden, and the idea is that any road fatality is too much. So we need to have a policy whereby we reduce road fatalities to zero.
And how do they go about doing that? What are some of the approaches to Vision Zero, Norman?
Well, there are lots of different. Well, as you know, traffic fatalities are caused by many different factors, including policies about alcohol use, for example, road design, the amount of vehicles on the road, how the vehicles interact with other users of the road. So a Vision Zero policy should look at the entirety of all of these different issues. And what they have done in places like Sweden is to first and foremost redesign the street so that they're not just about moving cars, but they're about all the other users of the road, but then also looking at policies such as the alcohol usage, such as who is responsible for road debt, who gets blamed when a road debt occur, things like that. That looks at all the different policies together.
Now, in New York City, they reduced the speed limit to 25 miles per hour. But as you just said, Norman, it's many different approaches in the Vision Zero strategy than just reducing speed. But when we look at speed, that has a lot to do with fatalities.
Well, there is a well-known research, I think it came out of the UK, which shows that as you increase speeds, the chance of dying in a road accident increases exponentially. So if you go from 20 miles per hour and you are hit in that kind of environment as a pedestrian, your chance of surviving is more than 90%. But if you increase the speed to 30 miles per hour, then the chance of surviving goes down dramatically, maybe to 30% or less.
Now, I believe the Vision Zero approach in New York City began under Mayor de Blasio back in 2014. Norman, when you hear that traffic fatalities have dropped significantly since record keeping began over a century ago, what's your take on that?
Well, firstly, I should say that a lot of the efforts that led to the changes that we have seen in New York goes back to Mayor Bloomberg and to his transportation secretary, Janet Satikan. So a lot of this precedes the current mayor, who has followed through on many of these efforts. And it's really encouraging to see the decrease that is happening in New York City, because it runs counter to what is happening in the rest of the United States. But it's not really surprising, because we have seen these kinds of drops in many places that have implemented some of the policies that we see being implemented in New York City.
What other places have implemented the Vision Zero strategy, Norman?
Well, they might not label it that, but a city like Zurich, for example, and Switzerland. Switzerland is now near the bottom of all countries in terms of road fatality, and they have implemented policies such as we see in New York, such as giving back space in the roadway to pedestrians, to bicyclists. In particular here, they have had a policy of increasing bike use, which has not been the case traditionally in Zurich.
And I mentioned Victor Dover is also with us, a co-author of the book Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. I had just asked Norman about speed and its relation to fatalities. In your book, you have this great diagram. I know we're on the radio, but if you could describe the cone of vision simulation and what happens when you see that speed limit dropping, Victor.
You know, the source for that image is the National Association of City Transportation Officials. And they found that when you're moving more slowly, and it's not too surprising, that you can just take in a lot more about what's going on through the windshield and through your and around in your surroundings. So, for example, if you're going faster than 30 miles an hour, you might only really be able to pay attention to the taillights of the car in front of you and the lanes right in the center of the roadway as you move through an intersection. But if you're going 15 miles an hour, your ability to realize what's going on around you, like, for example, a pedestrian stepping into the sidewalk from your peripheral vision, you become much more aware of it. And the benefit comes in two ways, and I think we see the statistic that Norm was describing about slower speeds improving safety because of these two things. First, you have more time to react because you're moving more slowly, so there are more seconds, there are more milliseconds that pass before something bad happens, like you strike a pedestrian. The second thing that happens is even if you do have a collision, it's going to be less violent. There's going to be less force and energy in it. And those two things combine to improve safety with slower speeds.
Victor, we were also curious to how the streets came to be, so to speak, here in the U.S., and how city streets and town streets were designed, what changed, where now we've been hearing about this approach to prioritizing pedestrian-friendly or bike-friendly streets. But that's not something that has been embraced when we look at what happened after World War II and how things were designed. Can you give us a little bit of that history?
There were really a couple of important inflection points in that timeline. First, in the 1920s, which Peter Norton writes about, the emergence of something they called organized motordom, which was really in response to a public backlash over all of the fatalities that were happening in the streets of our cities, children in particular, who had been accustomed to stepping out in the street without thinking about it. Were getting struck by cars, and these cars were, with each passing generation of automobiles, going faster and more quietly, so there was a greater danger for the pedestrians. And their solution to that was to really push pedestrians and cyclists and other road users out of the way, to take over much of the right-of-way, especially the center of it, for automobiles. And that's why we now have things like the term jaywalking. You know, that was an invention from that time period. Then after World War II, there was the full-on embrace of happy motoring, and what's good for General Motors is good for America. And the assumption was, at this point, the pedestrian world we used to know in our historic cities is pretty much over. It's going to be driving everywhere for everything every time. So let's make that fast and smooth and let everybody flow out, generally speaking, flowing from the old city where employment was still concentrated to the suburbs, and in the process sucking the economic power of the city out into the hinterland, but also pushing us as pedestrians farther out of the city. There's some early 1900s pictures in the book that show people standing in the center of the street waiting for a cable car, a streetcar, horses and buggies, bikes, Model Ts, trucks, all sharing the road, and no crosswalks and very little in the way of signage. Everybody was just sharing the speed. It was all because the speeds were similar between these different ways of moving about.
And these roads that were built to get people to the suburbs faster, interstates and roads that are, for the most part, very straight, which only drives people to go faster. You have a term in your book that describes what we have in many communities across this country, these interstate-like roads with strip malls on either side. What do you call those roads, Victor?
Well, the term I think you're thinking of is Chuck Marone's brilliant term, strode. It's not quite a street like we think of in the traditional city. It's not quite a road like a railroad. It's some hybrid in between. It actually fails us in both ways. It's not a great address. It's not a place where people want to be. And on the other hand, it's as wide as it is and as fast as it is, it's still jammed with traffic at the peak hour.
There's also another term in your book that we were looking at, the auto sewers.
Right. I think I heard that first from Jim Kunstler, who wrote the afterword in the book. He compared designing streets to designing a pipe for a sewer system, where the only thing you care about is how much you can get through the pipe or the lane of traffic in a given hour, kind of quantifying the so-called level of service in a road. It means you're designing a street like as if it was a sewer pipe.
Mm. This is Where We Live. Today we're speaking with Victor Dover, town planner and urban designer and founder of town planning firm Dover Cole & Partners, co-author of the book Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Also with us from Zurich, professor of civil environmental engineering at UConn, Norman Garrick, who's currently serving as a visiting professor at the Institute for Transportation Planning and Systems at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Today we're talking about ways communities can redesign their streets to make them more friendly versus just thinking about the priorities of moving the automobiles faster. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. And Norman, I mentioned that you're in Zurich. You've also been leading student groups in Amsterdam. This is a city famous for its bike culture. For those of us who haven't been to Amsterdam, describe how their city's streets are different from what we may see here in Connecticut.
Well, the first thing about Amsterdam that you notice is that there are bikes on every street. So in most cities in the world, we have created some bike facilities on some streets. In Amsterdam, that's the reverse. What you have, there are some streets that are not for cars anymore, so it's exactly the reverse. And the other thing that you notice is that there are bikes everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's like a sea of bike. And in sometimes it can be intimidating being in Amsterdam as a pedestrian, because there are just so many people and so many bells moving on bikes that if you don't have your wits around you, you have to jump out of the way sometimes.
I understand that European cities were headed to being more car-centric, like many places here in the U.S., but what changed for them where they were thinking about it in a different way?
Well, one of the points I like to make is that there are many car-centric cities in mm-hmm. Europe, mm-hmm. And the ones that are not are the exceptions, and we have to look at places like Oslo, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Zurich, and a few other Swiss cities, not all of them. The story of Zurich is emblematic of what happened in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, in that the official dam and the car lobbies, they wanted to create auto-oriented places. And this happened in the 60s. Mm-hmm. In Zurich, the pushback came because to change anything, you have to put it to a referendum. And so when the city officials, the canton officials, the federal officials were trying to build highways and to put the trams underground, they were defeated not once, but twice at the polls. And then they were forced to adopt something called the People's Plan for improving public transit and for prioritizing public transit. And I think if you look to the history of Zurich, that is what has created the city that we see now. Mm-hmm. It started around in the late 70s, And it's been a gradual process of changing the streets back to where they're people friendly, back to where they're better for tram and buses, and now for bicycle. And it's really changed the character of how people live here, but also how to get around. And also this issue of safety has been mightily impacted by some of those decisions from 40, 50 years ago.
And Norman, you've written about Zurich putting in something called parking maximums. Describe that for us.
So, yes, Zurich started, again, in the early 90s to look at this issue of parking. And the idea was that, well, actually, they call it something really dramatic. They call it the Grand Compromise. And the idea there was that they wanted to reclaim the streets and the squares in the center of town. They wanted to reclaim it for people use rather than for storage of cars. And so the idea was that they would not build any new or allow any new parking unless parking was removed from the streets. And I'm actually working with a master's student here to actually document the changes. And it's what he emphasizes is how gradual the change has been. But if you look at 1990 compared to now, is how dramatically it's changed. Places like there's a street called the Limerick Quay along the river, which you could never believe used to be a traffic sewer and is now for trams and for people and for bikers.
Now, Victor, you've written about the emphasis on placemaking when we think about designing communities and all the different types of people who use streets, not just cars. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. When we wrote the book, we thought it would be quick and easy because we spent a lot of time looking at streets over the years and working on street designs. But we took a trip, John Massengale, my co-author, and I took a trip, and another one, to photograph examples that we remembered or that had been recommended to us by people like Norm Garrick. And we photographed them, watched them under different conditions, and we measured them, and then we stayed up late at night arguing about why some were more successful than others. The bottom line is the streets that really perform well are the ones that are places where people want to be. So they are more than just transportation facilities for all the modes. They are also addresses. A place that you want to be is one you're likely to come back and spend more time or come back and have another meal and spend more money. And so the economic performance of the streets where people want to be became pretty apparent as well. And we noticed every time that those places were designed with the pedestrian on top of the food chain, on the top of the pyramid of priorities. And while cars are often, in most cases, accommodated in those streets, they aren't the start and finish of the design considerations. And we made a list of all the things that seem to occur over and over. So the streets where people want to be are shaped well by buildings and trees that make it feel like an outdoor public room. They tend to be inherently safe, either because the vehicles are moving slowly or because there's a kind of natural surveillance of the street, what Jane Jacobs called eyes on the street, and a few other factors.
Now, when we talked about European cities like Amsterdam that are very bike-friendly, and we see certain cities here in the U.S., putting in bike lanes, is that sending maybe the wrong message that, bicyclists need to stay in their lane and the car can take up the rest of the road, Victor?
Well, context is everything. We have a lot of streets where the appropriate response is to have dedicated, separated, and to the extent possible protected place to bike. That's different from the space within the right-of-way that the cars are using. So some streets call for that. And then other streets are ones where the operation of vehicles is so slow that streets and can be shared by pedestrians and people on bikes and by people moving slowly with cars or making deliveries in trucks. So I think the important word there is context. Mm-hmm. You find a bigger menu of street types instead of just one size fits all. The big news, though, in this renaissance of city cycling in North America, I think came about because of New York City's rapid progress. They did a lot of pilot and demonstration projects at very low cost to try bringing bikes and pedestrians into greater importance within the streets. And they immediately found that it was not just more welcoming and inviting for someone to use a bike instead of to drive, but also it was safer. And the safety improved not just for people on bikes, but for people in their cars as well. The data suggests that the one thing that made it lots safer to be out on two wheels was having a lot more people out there doing the same thing at the same time.
You can join the conversation here on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. Tony's calling from Hartford. Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling in. I wanted to get in early because it's a comment about framing the narrative and messaging. And when we talk about our streets and we sometimes focus on active transportation, bicycling, walking, and our transit users, we're leaving out a large segment of the transportation mode share in our area. And it's, you know, people are still driving cars. And when we talk about road safety, I think it's really important that we talk about how these safety improvements and road design changes are, you know, best serving the entire transportation network and the safety of all road users, and how the crashes and fatal crashes goes down for car drivers as well.
Thank you, Tony, for your comment. Norman, would you like to respond?
I think the point is well taken that in all the data that I've looked at, as you improve safety for bikers and for pedestrians, you also see a much safer environment for people in cars. And I think that is one of the strongest arguments for changing how we design streets, because in the U.S., we are back to killing 40,000 people per year. And this is three times the rate of fatality of a lot of countries in Europe. So there is a huge problem that we need to address. And this is part of the answer to that problem.
And Victor, before we head to break, did you want to add to that?
Well, first, I couldn't agree more with Tony's comment. He's absolutely right. And there's more to the street design challenge than just slowing the vehicles down or making space for pedestrians, street trees, and people on bikes. It's also about restitching the network. So that we have the city designed more like a web with a lot of intersections and a lot of interconnecting links, and less like a tree where everybody is being brought back to the same trunk line road for their basic daily trips. That's the bigger challenge that comes from the design of the neighborhood, not just from the design of one street. But the result of that is that everybody wins, especially the motorist, who now finds there are many ways to get from here to there, even though they're moving more slowly and safely.
Victor Dover is a town planner and urban designer, founder of town planning firm Dover Cole & Partners, co-author of the book Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Victor, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Norman Garrick will stay with us, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UConn, as we talk about strategies to ease traffic and make the road safer for everyone. One way, traffic circles. Now, someone in our newsroom mentioned how much he hates traffic circles. Why do people either love them or hate them? We're going to talk to a man in the UK who leads an appreciation group for traffic circles or roundabouts. He has another name for them. We'll tell you more after the break, and you can join the conversation too. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. There are a few traffic circles in Connecticut. The Monroe Courier says one will soon open in the town of Monroe June 4th. Now, how do you feel about traffic circles? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Now, who can forget that classic scene from National Lampoon's European Vacation?
I guess what we do is just drive around this circle here. It should be the second left exit. There's the hotel. Hey, look, kids! There's Big Ben and there's Parliament!
There it is.
I know. I can't seem to get over to the left, honey. I'll try next time. Sorry. We'll get out of this jam in a minute.
Kids, Big Ben,
Parliament, begin.
Kids.
We know, Big Ben.
Parliament.
Ah, the Griswolds. Now, are they a better option, traffic circles, that is, than traffic lights? And what are the benefits of installing traffic circles to manage a traffic flow and increase safety? Joining us by phone now from Redditch, Worcestershire, is Kevin Beresford, president of UK Roundabout Appreciation Society. Kevin, welcome to our show.
Also known as Lord of the Rings. That's my official title. Hi there.
Thank you for joining us today. Now, here in Connecticut, we're used to calling this type of strategy on the road a traffic circle or a rotary. There's lots of different names for them, and you also call them something else.
Yes, well, they're roundabouts, obviously, and also they're one-way gyratories, which is what I prefer. I like the sound of a one-way gyratory. It's the French that thought that one up.
So here in the U.S., we're used to traffic signals, but this is something that you don't like, the traffic lights that tell you when to stop and when to go.
Well, with the roundabouts, it's so quintessentially English, isn't it? It's all based on a set of decorum and etiquette. It's a bit of no after you, yeah? Because you choose when you want to join that flow of traffic. Whereas traffic lights, I mean, come on, they're telling you when to stop, when to go. We don't like that in Britain. We like to do our own thing with politeness and decorum.
Besides appreciating people being civil to each other, when we look at data here in the U.S., when they study intersections that have been converted from traffic signals or stop signs to roundabouts, that's something very telling about reducing the number of injury crashes of 72% to 80% and a reduction of all crashes of about 35% to 47%. So why are they safer, Kevin?
I think it's because when you look at intersections, everyone's going in a different direction. Whereas on a roundabout, we're all traveling in the same direction, and it's at a much slower speed. If there's a collision on a roundabout, you're just talking of a side swipe. Whereas on intersections, it's a full-on head-on collision, which is where all your fatalities come from. And I agree with your stats to a degree, but I thought it's something like 90% saving in fatalities if a roundabout is installed over traffic lights. I mean, that's quite an alarming stat, isn't it?
It is, and I'm curious, when we think about, you'd mentioned that roundabouts are definitely something that people in the UK appreciate, and it's quintessentially British, so to speak, but where was the first roundabout created? Was that here in the U.S.?
Can you believe in New York City, yes, in 1905. Can you believe that? In Columbus Circle. But they never really took off because it was more or less a free-for-all, you know. The traffic that was entering the roundabout had right away. But now it's a much more simpler now in England and the continent. So you just yield to the traffic coming from the left, you know. And the ones going round the circle have right away. And that's all it is. It's not rocket science here. That National Lampoon European Vacation has got a lot to answer for. It really has, you know. Because for some reason, America is opposed or weary of roundabouts. And I can't understand it because all the stats point to fatality where traffic lights are installed as opposed to roundabouts.
Now, Kevin, we're going to be talking about in a little bit how there are different cities and towns that are now embracing the roundabout, the traffic circle. Your phone's a little bit crackly, I think, because it's your cell. And again, you're calling us from the UK. So hopefully your line clears up a little bit. But I wanted to take a call, and you can join the conversation too, 860-275-7266. Kate's calling from Glastonbury. Kate, go ahead.
I grew up in South Jersey, so that's where I learned how to drive in a circle. And here it strikes me in Connecticut that the DMV could do a better job of just teaching people how to take turns and how to adjust their speed. I'm thinking about the circle by Bushnell Park near the State House, which has stop signs, and that causes a lot of trouble. And I look at the new circle rotary in Glastonbury, and that immediately struck me as too small.
Mm. Well, Kate, thank you for your call. Norman Garrick is with us. Also, he's with us from a studio in Zurich. Norman, let's talk about the way traffic circles or roundabouts are designed here in Connecticut, because depending on the way they're designed, they're not quite the same, and depending on where you are.
Well, the British came up with the term modern roundabout from around the 1960s to talk about the creation that came later. And in Kevin is right that the movie has a lot to answer for, but it's not just a movie. It's also how we used to design these New England traffic circles, these massive traffic circles with vehicles flowing through very fast and having a reverse priority compared to the modern roundabouts. Those things are uniformly hated in New England. And that's part of the problem, is that we are going to a different kind of design with these smaller roundabouts where you have to yield to the person in the roundabout and stuff like that, lower speeds, etc. So I guess the big point I want to make is that not all round things are the same in the road. They serve different purposes, they have different functions, and some of them are pretty horrible. So we need to actually make a distinction between roundabouts that are well-designed and traffic circles that are hellish. Mm.
So what you're saying, Norman, so we might use the term rotaries, traffic circles, roundabouts interchangeably, but they're actually there are differences between them depending on the way that you're able to drive into one, whether you're yielding, whether you're at a stop sign, and these multiple lanes in the middle.
Multiple lanes in the middle, whether or not they're huge or they're smaller, whether or not in Seattle they have something called a traffic circle, which is really lovely because it slows down traffic in neighborhood streets, and it's also used for planting trees. So it adds lots of amenities to the neighborhoods. And I wish we would use some of those in a place like Hartford. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of different things. It's deceiving when we talk about these as all being the same.
Now, again, I mentioned Kevin Beresford is with us, president of the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society. Kevin, can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
So tell us a little bit about what Norman was saying about the modern roundabout and the way they're designed, where you have things in the middle that complement the neighborhoods and the communities that they're in.
There's nothing more expressive than the one-way gyratory. And I've seen statues, paintings, trains, boats, planes, pubs, churches, anything can go on a roundabout. And I think that's what makes them so special in the UK. They lift our sagging spirits on long, tiresome journeys. It gives any local council brimming with a degree of civic pride the perfect opportunity to put a garden in the middle of a road junction. How green is that? How green is that as opposed to traffic lights? There's no green in traffic lights, only red.
And we have pictures of some of those roundabouts on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Bob's calling from Bristol. Bob, go ahead.
Hi. Lucy, thanks for taking the call. I love the conversation. And I would say, I think, backing up Dr. Norman, yeah, there are roundabouts and there are roundabouts. I grew up in the South and they were called traffic circles. But two stories about Connecticut or New England. One is there is a wonderful roundabout leading down to Hammonasset. You get off the I-95, you have to do a roundabout. It's wonderful. It just takes you right to where you want to go. On the other hand, I have to tell you a nightmare story. My wife and I were vacationing around Massachusetts, and she was driving, and she got caught in the most horrific roundabout near Concord. It was four lanes wide. You had to move from the inside to the outside to get to where you wanted to get in. And I thought at one point, we were going to have to change sides. She was going to have to move over, and I was going to have to get in the car on the driver's side because she was just stuck. She was panicked about how to move from inside to outside in a four-lane rotary. And I just there are good things and bad things, and I appreciate the fact that in England they've come up with a better design, but today it's humorous, but then it was sort of frightening. So, but the one in Hammond Asset, leading to Hammond Asset, is just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Bob, for your call, and we're glad that your wife is okay after that experience. But he did bring up a good point, and I'll go back to Norman Garrick, that when we're driving around in Massachusetts, there's definitely a lot more of these traffic circles that are present, and depending, again, we just talked about this, the way they're designed, if people don't know how to navigate them, they can be dangerous as well.
I also want to tell you a story about how we use language. A colleague from the CNU, Doug Farr, designed a roundabout in a city in Illinois, and it was rejected by the engineers, and they fought for years about the city wanted to implement it, but they fought for years and lots of frustration, and finally the engineer kept saying that we don't. The idea of this roundabout was that people were allowed to party and to have a park in the middle. And the engineering kept saying that roundabouts don't have people in the middle. And finally, Doug hit upon the solution of changing the name to a traffic circle, and that solved the problem for this engineer. So it's kind of crazy how we use the language, and also how hidebound the engineering profession can be about design.
Now, what about cyclists? So we're talking about when you mentioned the caller mentioned the circle down by Hammond Asset. We heard another caller mention the circle that's near downtown Hartford when you get off the highway. But when you're on a bicycle, the way that they're designed, is it tricky to navigate that when the cars are not quite sure how to go about it?
Most definitely. In fact, I keep thinking about a roundabout that I used to have to negotiate when I lived in Cambridge, England, and I went out of my way not to go through that roundabout because it depends, again, how it's designed. It can be really treacherous for a person on bike. But there are lots of ways to deal with bike traffic through roundabouts, and there are lots of great models, especially from the Netherlands, about how bicycle traffic is dealt with in the roundabout.
This is Where We Live. Today we're looking at ways to make our streets safer for everyone, pedestrians, those in cars, those on bicycles. And you can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. This segment we're talking about traffic circles as one way to slow people down and also ease traffic. On the phone with us is Kevin Beresford, president of UK Roundabout Appreciation Society, and Norman Garrick joining us from Zurich. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UConn. I want to take another call. Allison from Fairfield. Allison, go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
We're doing well. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, there's two things. One is that I spent a lot of time in France in the countryside, and there are a tremendous amount of roundabouts, and each one has a garden or a statue or something. The French are also, you know, very expressive, so they can be kind of kitschy and funny. So I did a photo documentation of my trips with pictures of every single roundabout sculpture or garden in the south of France and in the Auvergne. So they're nuts about them. But the other thing is, here in Fairfield, we have two really good roundabouts, and they changed one of them into a light. So you're sitting at the light for a long time and going through the I don't know what you call it now, I guess a traffic circle. And my question is, I've understood that it's less environmentally friendly to sit at a light versus going through a roundabout or a traffic circle. Is that true?
That's a good question, Allison. Kevin, do you want to help answer that?
Yes, I can. Traffic lights, if a roundabout is installed over traffic lights, there's 40% reduction in emissions, in fuel emissions, and that's why they're a lot greener, because there's a constant flow through the roundabout, whereas traffic lights, you're just idling for minute after minute when you're not going nowhere, so you're just pumping out exhaust fumes. So roundabouts are a lot more greener, and that research figure has come from US research figures.
And again, you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Mike's calling from Glastonbury. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from Glastonbury, and I'm calling regarding the incredibly controversial rotary in our town. And I attest to our specialist idea that it really depends on the politeness and courtesy. I was excited to hear this rotary being built, but so disappointed that the people in the town drive so aggressively that it's just not working. Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
That is unfortunate, and it speaks to something that our guest Kevin mentioned about why the roundabout works better in the UK, not as aggressive drivers, depending on what town you're in, Kevin?
It's a question of attitude, is that what you're saying? A lot of it can be to the road markings. If the road markings are incorrect, then it can cause confusion. But I've driven in America, and I don't find Americans aggressive drivers.
Have you been to Connecticut, Kevin?
No.
may I just interject?
Go ahead, Norman.
I agree with Kevin totally. I mean, the way that the road design makes a huge difference. I've measured speeds in stores, and you can go a few feet, and the road changes totally, and people are behaving totally differently. So I think we should look towards how that roundabout is behaved rather than blaming people from Glastonbury as being aggressive.
Well, we thank you for that, Norman, to remind us about that. But I want to thank our guest from the UK, Kevin Burrisford, again, president of the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society. He's also known as Lord of the Rings. We see what you did there, Kevin. And we understand that you also have calendars of roundabouts. We're going to put a link out on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, coming up, we're going to switch a little bit and talk about what other strategies Connecticut cities and towns are doing to make the roads safer. New Haven has been experimenting with a cost-friendly approach. More after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about the way streets are designed to put people, not cars, as a priority to improve safety for everyone. And with us from a studio in Zurich is Norman Garrick, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UConn, currently serving as a visiting professor at the Institute for Transportation Planning and Systems. Also joining us now is Doug Housladen, director of transportation, traffic, and parking for the City of New Haven. Doug, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
So before we run out of time, we've heard this idea previously about complete streets, a philosophical shift in how we think about designing streets and working with everyone in communities to make the roadways safer. I'm curious what New Haven's doing there.
Well, New Haven passed a complete streets ordinance after 2008 had a series of tragic pedestrian deaths. Community came together, the New Haven Safe Streets Coalition, passed the Complete Streets Ordinance, and that ordinance literally reprioritized the roadway design for the engineers of the City of New Haven to prioritize active transportation more and put on the add to it a vulnerable user element so that we actually look at more than just vehicle throughput as a measure of success.
So we were talking about all these different ways of helping improve safety, but sometimes that can involve a lot of dollars. And so what is New Haven doing to do it on the cheap, so to speak, but also making improvements that you're seeing results?
Well, we've been able to use some lighter and quicker tactical urbanist methodology. For instance, with respect to testing whether or not concrete construction would work, we've been able to place traffic cones in the right-of-way, put up temporary signs and temporary tape, and then measure the impact from respect to the traffic counts as well as our neighborhood benefit. You know, we've been learning a lot from watching folks like Street Plans out of New York, leading the way in tactical urbanism and trying to do things in a shorter term so that residents who are complaining can work with us to iterate. It's a very uncomfortable place for a lot of folks to be in, frankly, because we'd rather have a full project and spend the real dollars on concrete. But in the interim, while folks are waiting and our job is to mitigate risk, we have to be trying more and doing more.
So tactical urbanism, so it's like a trial and error approach to urban planning?
In a way, and really there's a lot of concepts out there to use. There's really a tool belt of traffic calming methods, and to figure out which is the best for the situation, sometimes you do want to have a little bit of trial. One thing we've really worked with our community on, the New Haven Bike Month group has been using our stencils. We bought stencils for bike lane stencils, and we lend them out to the community. So they use duct tape, cornstarch, water, and food coloring, and make temporary pop-up bike lanes when they have road closure festivals. And it's a great way to just to get out there and get the community more comfortable. To the caller's point, you know, a lot of our communities are seeing a lot of fast traffic, and so just getting them used to, you know, having other users in the roadway is really important.
Norman Garrick's with us. What's your take on Complete Streets 2.0, Norman?
I think the idea of tactical urbanism has been a really powerful one, partly out of the Congress for the New Urbanism. What it does is that we, in the past, we would plan a lot of what gets done on the streets based on engineering models or engineering ideology. And what tactical urbanism does is gets you to try different things. So is it actually going to slow down the traffic? Is it actually going to cause traffic congestion? Is it actually going to slow down the traffic? So you get to try things in a cheaper way or a quicker way, and then you can demonstrate that some of these ideas actually work. And in fact, if we look at what was done in New York City, it was really a grand use of tactical urbanism on Broadway. The Broadway closing was really using very cheap and very temporary type of solutions. And then over time, they made it more permanent as they saw how well it worked.
New York, when they've had some of those approaches in New York City, Norman, there was some backlash, especially when certain parking spaces were eliminated.
Yes, and this is exactly what tactical urbanism does. It addresses the potential for these criticism, because then it shows the reality rather than the fear. So even though Woody Allen is against bike lanes in Manhattan, you can use tactical urbanism solutions to actually test the fear and also to test the hope of the people on the other side. And so things like the bike lane in Prospect Park was very, very, very unpopular. And now that it's been implemented, so as you implement things, you can see the reality, and you can also test whether or not it needs to be tweaked and made better. So what is working, what is not working?
Speaking of bike lanes, just to get a little more of an idea of what other changes have happened in the city of New Haven, Doug Houseladen, I understand there's also wrong direction bike lanes.
Yes, we've been able to find space in the right-of-way for cyclists. So in High Street in downtown New Haven, we've been able to install a contraflow bike lane to allow folks in our one-way grid to sort of cut four blocks out of their commute to get from A to B. And so infrastructure is incredibly important, but if it doesn't get you the entire way, if there's gaps in your infrastructure, or if it makes it too hard, you're not going to see the behavior change. And we've been really proud of how folks have been opting out of the car in New Haven, and I'm really excited about the new census to see our numbers. In addition to Contraflow, we've been able to install, thanks to the 2015 bike bill, we've been able to install two-way cycle tracks. Our favorite design is on Long Wharf Drive, and that was really a partnership with the state DOT and how we wanted our local roadway restored after they left from the Q Bridge project. So it was an opportunity to sneak some alternative transportation infrastructure in on a maintenance budget when something was already committed with federal funds. And so it's been a very successful project, just again, reordering the right-of-way and making sure folks know that there is a place for them if they're on two wheels or on foot. Mm.
Doug Houseladen, again, is Director of Transportation, Traffic, and Parking for the City of New Haven. Doug, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Complete Streets 2.0.
Thanks so much, and happy Memorial Day, everybody.
Also, Norman Garrick, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UConn, who is currently serving as Visiting Professor at the Institute for Transportation Planning Systems at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, joining us from Zurich today. Thank you so much, Norman. We appreciated your perspective.
It was a great pleasure being home for a bit. Thank you so much.
Take care. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to Kyone Wolf and Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have a great weekend.